Though the first time I drank, felt like, oh, this is the thing that's been missing. Mm-hmm. Because I'm a perfectionist. I'm the eldest daughter. I just always wanted everyone to think I was perfect. And that started from a very young age. So it was the same way with my peers. Like, how can I dress? How can I act? How can I talk so that everyone will like me? The therapist said, will you go to an AA meeting? And I was like, that's not what I want to do. Please don't tell me that I have to quit drinking, because it was just such a part of my life and the only time I had any relief. And I was desperate enough and ready that I heard what people were saying for the first time and related and cried and thought, like, how did they know how I felt? Like, they were describing how I was feeling inside and I couldn't put words to it, and they were. I now have entered a life of recovery. My kids won't see that from me or my husband and I, and so they're being raised in a different way. And so hopefully we've ended that generational cycle.
Heather, thank you so much for joining me on Pressure Tested. I'm so excited to have you here.
Thank you, Kelly. I'm excited to be here.
Okay, I'm going to go into this, and it's maybe slightly inappropriate. I'm going to talk about it anyway. So I was recently, I'm on the foundation board of Nexus, and I was recently at one of the board meetings. And I have to tell you, I've never been so impressed with somebody's professionalism as I was that day, because you had brought up something that was very difficult to talk about, and it was received not well at all in the room. And I think a lot of people kind of jumped to different, just ideas in their brain about what you had said. And I'm definitely not going to say the word attacked you, but definitely had some things to say back to you about it. And it was that moment that I realized I would never run a nonprofit, because I would never be that cool with somebody kind of coming at me like they did. Yeah. But how did you do it? I mean, I know you remember the moment. I mean, mm-hmm. I think you even thanked them for their feedback, and it was not disingenuous. You thanked them for their feedback and just got the control of the room back. How do you do those things?
So I think and thank you for noticing that, because I did not know if that's what I was like, okay, what's she going to say when she said we're not going to go? But thank you for noticing that, because that feels really nice to be seen in that way. And I would say it's all about the relationships that I have with those people outside of the room. That's probably one of the most important things I've learned as a nonprofit leader, is that your relationships can get you through lots of difficult conversations, whether that be with board members or staff or donors. And I've got really open, honest, and transparent relationships with everyone in that room. And so we've invested time in one another, getting to know each other. They know that I'm a truthful, transparent person, and so they can ask me those questions. And hopefully I don't ever come defensive I don't get defensive, because I know that I'm being transparent and honest with them, and that I'm doing my best, and we as an organization are doing our best. But I think because I have good relationships with them, and I know they have the best intentions, and reciprocally, I think they know that of me, it was okay to not get mad in that moment and to be calm.
Wow. Well, I was so impressed by it. I was like, I have so much maturity to get through before I'm ever going to be this cool, calm, and collected. Tell me about Nexus. What is Nexus?
So we provide substance use disorder treatment for women only. That's one of our most unique characteristics. Back in 1971, when we were founded, there were 5 women that were sober in the DFW area. And they looked around and they said, there's no female-only treatment facilities. And that's really important, because when you're embarking on a recovery journey or a sobriety journey, it requires a whole lot of honesty and just vulnerability. And so going into an environment where there are men can be difficult sometimes, because you've either had bad relationships, or you can use men to distract you, mm-hmm. or there's all sorts of things that come along when you add men in the mix. And so these women said, you know, let's create a residential facility where women can come and focus on themselves and focus on their healing. And so from that beginning in 1971, we have kept that as a central part of our mission, that we are female only. And so what comes along with women oftentimes is children. Right. And so we treat women in all stages of pregnancy. And we're one of the only providers that does that, because when you're in your third trimester, there are extra complications and risks that can come along with treating women. And so we know that it's really important, though, that those moms get into treatment and are able to find sobriety while they're still pregnant, because it can dramatically improve birth outcomes. So even if somebody gets help, you know, and they're 28 weeks along, their baby can still have a healthy birth weight, really? Healthy head circumference, and wow. get help. Absolutely.
Kind of getting into the nitty gritty, but, and that's with any type of substance abuse. You've seen that be successful?
We have seen that being successful. Of course, wow. it depends on the, you know, the level of usage, sure. how long they've been using, just the genetics of the baby too. There are all kinds of factors and risk factors that come along with that. But everything from alcohol to opiates to anything.
Wow.
Yes, if you get treatment early, you can prevent that being in your baby system or having long-term outcomes with the baby being impacted. So we also allow moms to bring up to 3 children into residential treatment with them. So as a mother, usually if you need something for yourself, you put that on the back burner until your kids are okay.
Sure.
So, you know, if everybody in your house is sick and you're a mom, you're the one still up doing everything and caring for them, and you know, pop a Tylenol or Advil and keep going.
Right.
And keep taking care of them. So mom may know she needs help, but she doesn't have a safe or protective place for her kids to go. And so rather than risking them going into foster care, the system, mom will continue in her addiction until something really catastrophic happens. So we want to prevent that and have mom bring kid into Nexus with her. And those kiddos receive really robust wraparound services while mom is there as well. So substance use disorder is definitely a generational cycle. I can speak for myself. There's a long history of alcoholism and addiction in my family. It didn't skip me. Maybe it skipped my brother, I'm not sure, but definitely hit me. And so because I now have entered a life of recovery, my kids won't see that from me or my husband and I. And so they're being raised in a different way. And so hopefully we've ended that generational cycle, which is what we want for the families at Nexus too, is that those kiddos see mom building resiliency and building health and being able to take care of her family. So those kids' trajectory can be changed completely by coming into treatment with their mom. They also get really high quality childcare. So we have a fully licensed daycare on campus. And then we assess each kiddo for speech, occupational, and physical therapy,
okay.
as well as behavioral therapy. Because again, as a mom, if your kids aren't okay, you're not okay.
Right.
And so we want to make sure we're treating everyone and that they all leave there as a stronger and more resilient family.
So if you enter, and I think I remember you saying that it's a different amount of days if you enter without children mm-hmm. than if you do have children.
Yes.
So what's that about?
So for our women that are not actively parenting, the residential program is about 30 days. And if they have kiddos with them, it's about 90 days. And the reason it's a longer program is, one, we have the whole family there. And so it's a unique opportunity to do some deep work with all of them. And we do a lot of really supportive parenting skills mm-hmm. training with them. So
smart.
They're not just, you know, building up their recovery capital, but they're also learning how to build healthy routines with their kiddos, how to discipline them in an appropriate way, mm-hmm. how to model good behaviors, working on attachment with those kiddos. Because if you've lived with a parent with a substance use disorder or other mental health conditions, you've been impacted.
Right.
Right. And the person that shows up as your mom when they're active in recovery is very different than the mom that you've known that right. was kind of checked out and just physically there, but not paying attention and not actively parenting. Mm. And so we want them to leave understanding one another and having started on that relationship rebuilding before they're just thrown out into the world. And so we do a lot of behavioral modeling and a lot of trust building and just working on their relationships while they're there. So it's a longer program.
How many families do you think walk in the door that are coming from being homeless?
So about a fourth of our clients are unhoused when they come in through admissions. As high as 80% are looking for safe and supportive housing when they're discharging because they can't go back to the environment they were living in. So if, say, you were living with a boyfriend and that boyfriend was actively using, you don't want to go back and live there because that's going to be detrimental to your recovery, right? Or say you were staying on a friend's couch and that friend may not be supportive, or it may just not be what you want to go back to sure. because you want to be able to take care of yourself and be self-sustaining and self-supporting. So you want to save up and get your own apartment. So a lot of our clients are working on finding safe and supportive housing when they're leaving, as well as becoming financially independent, which isn't always what you think of when you think of treatment and substance use disorder. You just think of taking something away from someone's life, like removing the substance sure. and sobering up. But what I love about Nexus and why the mission is so incredibly vast is because we look at the whole woman and the whole family. And so just taking something away is kind of miserable, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
if that's what you use as your coping mechanism or as your way to move through the world, if you just take that away, all the other junk is still there. And we want to give back and have our clients see that their life can be different and be more. So by taking that substance away, you're now able to focus on getting a job, focus on treating any trauma that you've been impacted by negatively, take care of yourself, take care of your kids, and really be the woman you were meant to be from the very beginning. And so a lot of what we do is around building people up and not just taking something away.
How different is it to see that first person walk in the door and then to see what they look like 3 months later? Like, what does that even feel like for you?
It is the most magical thing ever. And I think before I came in, you told me to think about a story mm-hmm. that really highlighted what we do yeah. and why I'm still there. And I started at Nexus during COVID, which is in retrospect, horrible time to start a new job, yeah. Especially in a residential living environment. I had absolutely no experience in healthcare or in residential congregate living. My background is that I'm a CPA and came from public accounting. So I can tell you how to run a business and how operationally things should look on a balance sheet and income statement, but how to worry about or how to triage infection control, no clue.
Yeah.
How to social distance when you have old, not all of that was brand new. And so I started in June, and on 4th of July, I had to go into our pregnant and parenting women with children living space and let them know that we had had a staff member that was positive for COVID mm-hmm. and that they had all interacted with her. Mm-hmm. We were wearing masks. We were doing all the things to keep everyone safe. But still, our staff would go home at night, and they were around their family members and loved ones. And so this staff member had contracted COVID, so I had to go in and tell all the residents. And they don't have their phones with them when they're in treatment, and they aren't watching live cable news and things like that. Oh, so
interesting.
All the information they were getting was from word of mouth or what we were providing. And so they were scared, and they were angry, and they were like, why were we exposed? How do we all get tested? And I was freaking out on the inside. Like, I don't know. Like, I'm a mom as well. I understand why you all are fearful, because this was so early on in the pandemic.
Of course. No one knew anything about it yet.
And so there was this one girl in the corner and she looked me in the eye and she gave me that look of like, I have your back. And so she yells out to all the other residents, hey, give her a break. She's just trying to help us out. And I was like, I love you. Thank you so much for coming to my rescue. And she was just an amazing leader among her community of women getting sober. So fast forward to the next week, I was walking by the cafeteria and I had a photographer with me because we were taking pictures of the campus and getting ready to launch a campaign with our PR firm. And so the same young woman came and knocked on the window and asked us to come into the cafeteria because she saw the camera. Mm-hmm. They were having a surprise birthday party for her son. Aww. He was in treatment with her at Nexus, and they had been living there for over a month. So Zayden had made a ton of friends in the daycare. Mm-hmm. And again, it was COVID, so everybody was locked down together. We weren't having volunteers come in and out, and they weren't leaving campus at all. And so she asked if the photographer would take pictures of the surprise because it was the first time she had been sober for one of his birthdays. And so it was the first birthday party he had had.
Wow.
At 8.
At 8?
Yes. And so you think back of like all of your kids' birthday parties and all of like just the milestones that you celebrate, and she had missed those and she wanted to make up for it. And so the photographer and I kind of hid in the corner and Zayden walked in. There wasn't a dry eye in the room. Every mom was crying. We were crying.
It's tough.
And Zayden and Mackenzie were so happy. And I got to develop a relationship with them and get to know them as a mother and son while they were in treatment. And when they graduated, I gave them that picture framed. And so we stayed in touch. And fast forward 2 years from then, Mackenzie came back and worked at Nexus. So one of my absolute favorite things is not just when they walk out the door and they complete treatment, but so many women come back as alumni and work at the place that helped change them.
And that's great.
And so Mackenzie did that and she worked with us. Then after 2 years of being at Nexus, she decided her real dream was to become a police officer. So
really?
Yes.
Okay.
She
might have the personality for it though.
Absolutely does. When she stood up for me in that court, I'm like, yes, you shut that whole room down and you have the authority to do it.
There you go.
And so I got to attend her police academy graduation a few months ago. So just seeing people's lives changed and their dreams manifesting, like I don't even know if that was a dream of hers when she walked in the door or something that she thought she could ever do. And now she's an officer serving in a town not too far from here, and it's incredible. And so that is why we do it, and you can't describe it. You just get goosebumps every time.
Yeah, it's moments like this that I feel like that I really am truly such a pessimist, or maybe I just have such a, you know, a long sordid history with addiction and seeing people in addiction.
Yeah.
Tell me the other side of that. I mean, how many people have you met and, you know, developed a relationship with that just broke your heart?
That's the other side of it, right? Because it is a lifelong disease. And before working at Nexus, I really struggled with why am I able to participate in recovery and why are some of my family members not? Because I'll tell you, it's not about willpower, because these people are very the family member I'm thinking of in particular is extremely strong and can do anything he puts his mind to. It's not willpower. And so I struggled a lot with why is my life getting so much better and I'm able to do this and they're not.
You almost feel guilty.
You do. Yes. Like you feel chosen in some way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, why are other people helping me and not them? And the truth is they would just as easily help him if he would ask for the help.
Right.
But at Nexus, that's hard, especially when we've seen somebody with that light coming back in their eye and they're doing so great. And then a year later, they come back and they've had a recurrence. Mm-hmm. It's sad It's devastating.
Why recurrence instead of relapse? What's the difference in those words?
We try to be intentional in not labeling what somebody is or isn't. Mm-hmm. Or like I say, substance use disorder, which is only something I've used since I've been at Nexus. Right. I would always call myself an alcoholic, and I still call myself an alcoholic, but I would never call another woman an addict because it's not my place to label her. Mm-hmm. So we say somebody with a substance use disorder.
Okay.
Just like you wouldn't call somebody with schizophrenia crazy.
Right.
You might, fair. But not, you know, it's not great. It. So we say recurrence because it's not lapsing backwards. It's just something that happened at a point in time.
That's really powerful, actually.
And so that's how we try to look at it in terms of if somebody comes back and they were successful, of course it hurts and it's heartbreaking. But more than anything, we're grateful that they made it back.
Yep.
And that they didn't have an overdose and they didn't die.
Wow.
Those are the hard ones when there have been several clients that we'll hear of that passed away. And that is devastating.
Oh, well, I mean, it's one thing to have a relationship with these people who end up going back out, but you also have a relationship with their children.
Yes.
Which takes it to this, like, so far another level. Like, I could never do what you do. Like, I just don't have the emotional bandwidth to the emotional weight of what you do. Like, it's just, it's wild to me. Like, you were obviously meant to do this, and it's, I look up to you for doing it, but what a heavy load.
Well, I couldn't be in direct care.
So I agree with that. That'd be tough.
When I was leaving PwC, I thought I wanted to be a counselor. And so I actually went back to school to get my master's in counseling.
Okay.
I finished all the coursework, was the most annoying grad student in the planet because take an accountant and put them in a grad class.
Oh, I can't even imagine.
Something that's actually interesting. And I was just like, yes, because I'd been reviewing 10 Qs all day. And so I got to go to my master's class and I annoyed the hell out of all the undergrads that had just come into the master's program. But I got through all the coursework. And then when I was doing my practicum, I realized, oh, I don't have boundaries with clients. Like because I wanted to be a children's therapist too. And so I just wanted to save everyone.
Yeah.
You know, like, oh, you shouldn't. No, you come live with me.
Yeah. That's what I would be doing.
And it was, it's like rescuing animals too. And I know that's big for you. Like, you just want to take care of all of them. And then I started going through this existential thing of like, okay, well, if you save or help these 10 kids, what about the other hundreds of kids that don't have a safe and protective home? And so then it was like spinning out.
Yeah.
And my now husband, he was my boyfriend then, was like, I don't know if this is the best path for you because you're going to drive yourself insane. Like, your own mental health and your own sobriety, like, those things are all important, and you can't serve anyone else if you're up all night until 5 a.m. thinking, oh my God, I can't save all the kids.
Right.
So at that point, that's when I decided to shift a little bit and go into nonprofit leadership.
Okay.
Because I could use the skills and the professional tools that I had in a way to still help people. So I totally relate to what you're saying in terms of I couldn't do that. Because I look at our counselors and our case managers and our peer coaches, and I'm like, I couldn't do that. Like, I couldn't be on the other end of a phone call if somebody is in a drug house and needs them to come pick them up. I couldn't, and I know that.
Is that what Brandon does? Is Brandon a counselor?
Brandon is a counselor.
Okay.
So he does not – our coaches and case managers are the ones that get those in the middle of the night calls. What Brandon does is he works with our clients while they're in residential treatment and works with them on what are your motivations for getting better? What are your motivations for being in recovery? And they come up with a treatment plan that has goals in it. And they work on that while they're there. And then they work on a discharge plan. So he gets to know them really deeply inside and out just in terms of what is it that you want to change about yourself, and who do you want to be, really? And so I couldn't do that.
To people who find something later in life that they're so good at, like me. So me and Brandon started out at the same call center, mm-hmm. same HVAC call center, and we were both terrible. I mean, we didn't know what we were doing talking to people on the phone. Like, I remember our manager Donna being like, "Okay, from now on, I'm just going to write everything you say because you guys have no idea yes. what to say here."
Another just, job I couldn't do yeah. would be a call center job
because we feel like call and they yell at you, and me yeah. and Brandon are like, who the heck are these people? Yeah. Anyway, we were not good at that job. But it's so great to hear that he found something that he is so good at.
He's
amazing.
That's
so amazing.
Yeah.
I loved getting to see him that day. That was so fun.
Yeah. He, a client just came to me 2 days ago and they were like, if it hadn't been for Brandon and how much he cared and how much he asked me, who do I want to be? And because when you are in an active addiction or substance use disorder, you spend so much time just thinking, this is not what I want. This is not what I want to be. This is not who I am to my friends and my family. And there's so much shame. So to actually think about, what do I want to do? Mm-hmm. Or what kind of person am I at my core, is such a different perspective.
Sure.
And just gives you something to look forward to. And he's really, really good at that.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
I love that. That's great. I've never even really thought about that. Man, this like conversation is so heavy. We're like I'm just trying to think back to our last podcast, and I had this friend of mine on, and we were just like, she's just like really funny.
Uh-huh.
And we were just like laughing and she's like also really successful. I could not get her like back on track to talk about what she actually does. And
yeah.
so this conversation is like obviously the opposite of that. I'm so happy that we're having it though, because I think I don't think enough people know about Nexus and what you guys do. There's something you said to me that I want to talk about, and I'm completely off script, so sorry. But
no,
you said something about and it's back to this like label idea about, you know, not saying that people are sober and like how, you know, some people need certain drugs to kind of help them cope, like they need depression drugs, or kind of tell me a little bit about that, because I thought it was so unique because I'd never heard it before.
Yeah. So I think what you're referring to is we talked about pathways to recovery mm-hmm. and how not everyone's pathway or how they do this looks the same. So, for example, I got sober through Alcoholics Anonymous and therapy. I went to a therapist because I was suicidal and said, I'll literally do anything you tell me to do, like including hospitalization or putting me in an institution, because I can't do this anymore. I don't know how I'm going to survive. Now, granted, this will really highlight that you don't know what people are going through, because at the same time, I was getting promoted early every year at PwC. I had really high profile clients. I was doing amazing at work. My family still loved and supported me, and I had friends. So the people close to me that I would open up to and tell them how like sad or depressed I was just thought it was depression. But they had no idea how bad it actually was mm-hmm. and that I was that devastated on the inside. So I say that to say the therapist said, well, will you go to an AA meeting? And then all of a sudden I was like, oh, shit, no. Like, that's not what I want to do. Like, you can put me in an institution, but please don't tell me that I have to quit drinking.
Oh, man.
Because it was just such a part of my life and the only time I had any relief. But I'm also somebody that will do what I say I'm going to do. So because I told her I would do anything, I said, okay, I'll go to a week of AA meetings and then I'll come back to you next week and then we can figure out what I'm going to do, because that's not going to work. So I went in there and I was desperate enough and ready that I heard what people were saying for the first time and related and cried and thought, like, how did they know how I felt? Like, they were describing how I was feeling inside, and I couldn't put words to it, and they were. And so, for me, that's how I started this journey. And AA is an abstinence-based program. Mm-hmm. So, I stopped drinking. I didn't moderate. I didn't try to, you know, just drink wine or anything like that, because for me, that's what I needed. Now, at the same time, I had a sponsor that also had a history with mental health and depression, and she was very supportive of me going on an antidepressant because she said, you know, we've taken the alcohol out of the system. For me, I didn't do any other drugs, but I couldn't, the deep depression just wouldn't go away. And she's like, this is a tool for you to be able to function. And so that's how I looked at it. And I still look at it that way today. The thing that was causing me deep grief and trauma and not being able to live up to my full potential was the alcohol. So that's the thing that was removed. I still stayed on an antidepressant or went on an antidepressant to help me. We kind of follow that same approach at Nexus in that if somebody comes into treatment for methamphetamines, because that is what is causing them deep distress and destruction in their life, not to be what they want it to be, but they feel like they can drink, well, that's not for us to judge or for us to prescribe one way for them to be live on this path. We also use medicated assisted treatment. So we use Suboxone. A lot of people are familiar with methadone. Both of those things are tools to help people get past withdrawals and cravings. You wouldn't tell somebody with high blood pressure, ooh, don't take that statin.
Yeah.
Like, you've just got to control it with diet. It's just so, it's fascinating that we're, as a society, we're comfortable with people on blood pressure medication or something for diabetes. GLP-1s are everywhere. You know, or even insulin, but that is a tool to help a diabetic regulate their blood sugar, much like Suboxone is a tool to help people stay active in their recovery. So that's the path we take and approach. We also don't want anyone to be, I won't say turned off, but for anyone to have a barrier of getting into a recovery journey because we prescribe only one way to do it, right? So if you've experienced religious trauma, for example, and you go into a treatment facility that is completely faith-based or spiritual, you're going to run out the door because you're only going to attach to that. And again, you'll use all kinds of, and I did this myself, reasons not to attach to something. And so if you've got a negative connotation with religion or spirituality or God or any of that, that's the thing that you're going to use to go. And so we don't want to ever tell somebody there's only one way to do this and you have to do it that way. Not that there's anything wrong with programs that do, it's just not the approach we take.
That's so insightful, because I was talking to somebody about Nexus recently, and you know, and it's fine, you know, but the very first thing that they said was, is it a faith-based program? And when I said no, they just kind of stopped listening. And I was like, what? What just happened? But I couldn't put into words what you just put into words. Yeah. And I think that makes so much sense. Okay, but I really want to know more about how somebody climbs the ranks at some major accounting firm while struggling with what you struggled with. So it's kind of like, break it down. Like, how old were you when you started drinking? And what did it look like at the end? Like, how much were you drinking?
So I started drinking at 14. I grew up in Arkansas, and so there really wasn't a lot else to do, which sounds terrible, but I'm glad my kids are growing up.
I forgot you're from Arkansas. Where at in Arkansas?
I'm from Bentonville.
Okay. Oh, that's
so my dad was an executive with Walmart.
Okay.
And so I grew up in Bentonville. Started drinking at 14 because everybody else was drinking in high school. Now that terrifies me because I have a 9-year-old daughter.
Me too.
My daughter, 14 is so young.
My 15-year-old daughter has never even been to a boy-girl party. The idea of her, you know, having a drink so is so completely unheard of.
Which I'm so grateful kids now
kids
seem
are
to
totally
be
different now.
Yes.
It's so, I mean, what? I'm
their
happy.
Worlds are bigger and they have other things to focus
when
on.
When I was 14, I was like, yeah, yes. let's go. Let's go to the party.
Yeah, we had nothing else to do. So The first time I drank, felt like, oh, this is the thing that's been missing. Mm. Because I'm a perfectionist. I'm the eldest daughter. I just always wanted everyone to think I was perfect. And so I also come from an alcoholic home and family. And so I'm really good at reading a room. You walk in and you kind of figure out, like, what kind of mood is everybody in? Mm. How many drinks have they had? Are they the happy drunk, or are they the don't look at me or you're going to get yelled at drunk? Like, trying to figure that out. And that started from a very young age. So it was the same way with my peers. Like, how can I dress? How can I act? How can I talk so that everyone will like me? Because I didn't like myself. And so I always wanted to fit in. And so when I drank, though, I wasn't doing all of that mental gymnastics, sure, trying to figure out what everybody thought. And I just felt hilarious and really pretty.
Alcohol will have that effect on people.
All those things are just like, oh, this, I can finally relax at 14, right? Like, I can finally relax. But that's what that was the attraction to it, was that I didn't have to try so hard. Mm-hmm. And I could just be whatever I was in that moment. Now, I blacked out almost immediately when I started drinking at 14, and this is very embarrassing to admit, but I didn't understand that not everyone blacked out until I got sober at 28.
Wow.
I thought every time everybody drank, that's what they did. Hmm. It was just
part of it. So, I mean, I swear to this, I've never blacked out from drinking. And so, like, you just keep drinking and keep drinking until you just lose consciousness? Like, you just pass out? Or, like, what do you mean?
So, for me, and I think I know, like, my friends in AA especially have described, I would be awake and functioning and talking and doing all the things, but have no memory of it the next day.
Got it.
So what I hated more than anything is when, I can really remember it in college, when my sorority sisters would be like, oh, last night when you said blah, 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 that was so funny. Or do you remember dancing at such and such house? And I wouldn't remember any of it.
You wouldn't remember any of it?
No. And so you can imagine, like, that put me in a lot of really bad situations.
Yeah.
But that's what I mean by blacking out. And then eventually I would pass out, but I'm just big chunks of time missing.
Wow.
Now, the reason I say from firsthand experience that alcoholism and addiction is not about willpower is because at the same time that I was drinking to black out, I graduated summa cum laude from a pretty hard college. I got a job at a big four accounting firm. I was promoted earlier. Like, I could perform. I couldn't stop drinking, though.
So you drink every day?
I didn't drink every day. So that's the other kind of misconception, is that people assume that you have to drink every day, or that there's a magic quantity, or that there's a, like, a level of, oh, they must be an alcoholic. For me, I was so dead and depleted on the inside that I couldn't go on. So I binge drank Thursday through Sunday. So Thursday would roll around, I would start drinking. I was usually pretty hungover at work on Friday, but then I'd hit it really hard Friday through Sunday.
Dang.
And then the same in college. So there's a level of control there that I had. I didn't drink during the day because I didn't want to get in trouble at work. During the day, during the week, I, of course, was the first one at brunch or anywhere that you could start day drinking.
Sure.
So I don't know. Like, I was really fortunate that I didn't have to go through detox because I wasn't drinking daily. And the amount
I was
drinking, my body was able to
handle it. Wow. That's great.
It doesn't mean, yeah, I mean,
the detox from alcohol is terrible.
You can die from it. That's right. And I've seen people go through detox on their own, and it's awful. the physical symptoms are terrible. There's a lot of seizures involved. Like, I'm really grateful that I didn't go through any of that.
I think a lot of people don't realize that when you detox from alcohol, it can look like coming off of opiates or Xanax or any
of a lot of shaking, a lot of seizures. It's crazy, it's bad.
What do you, so, you know, you talked a little bit about feeling like you had depression or that you do have depression and that you use antidepressants to help. How much do you think alcohol just made that so much worse in your
brain? Oh, 100%. It made it so much worse because alcohol is a depressant and it allowed me not to focus on the real issue, right? So this sounds crazy, but I was digging myself into more of a hole with the alcohol and not having to do any trauma work on what was actually making me sad. And so it would just keep building up too, because I would disappoint people or I would let friends down by not showing up or, you know, let my family down by saying mean things to them when I was drunk. And so then I felt bad about those things and I was never doing the work on why I felt like I was other when I was a kid. So, yeah, it just kept compounding the issue. Yeah.
How long have you been sober now?
Almost 15 years, January 11th, 2011.
Good for you. That's great.
Yeah, thanks.
I love that. So with Nexus, tell me a little bit about rebuilding the campus and why that's what you guys are working on there.
Yeah. So it's such an amazing place for all the reasons I've said. Now, those are all the people that work there that make it that amazing. What quickly surfaced when I stepped in as the leader was that there had not been a lot of investment in the buildings and the physical plant and the facilities or the infrastructure. Some of that is because we're partially publicly funded and public dollars usually can't go towards capital improvements.
What?
Yes.
Okay. Say, sorry. Say what?
So public funds.
Okay. It's public funds because you have heads, you have beds.
Yes.
And people in the beds. But can't go to capital improvement.
Yes. Unless it's a grant specifically for capital projects.
Okay. That just blew my mind.
So
how does that make any sense?
So we would have to privately fundraise to do any capital improvements. And that just wasn't something that they were focused on at the time. The previous leadership purchased the property in 1991, and it had already been in existence for 30 years at that point. So, you know, just on a depreciation schedule, it's a fully depreciated asset that you're purchasing. But
you are an accountant at heart.
Yeah, it's my love language. And so we made the best use of it as we possibly could. So I think coming in, and I do have a very strong faith, so I do think this was definitely a God thing. When I came in and it was COVID, we were kind of forced to look at our physical space with new eyes, right? Like anyone that was stuck at home with their families were like, our kitchen's too small, our bathroom's too small, we need to renovate.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, that makes sense.
Same thing in a facility, because for the first time, we were thinking about social distancing in our groups, and we had never done that before, right? And so it was like, oh, the space is really small. Oh, these stairs are kind of dangerous, or we can't really keep, you know, if you've got a family that one of the kiddos is COVID positive, you don't want them sharing a bathroom with somebody else. So we kind of just looked at things completely different at that time. So we had an architecture firm come out just to ask them, what could we do with the buildings that we have now? Because we would like for there to be more space. We'd like for there to be more natural light. Like, there's so much science and data now saying how natural light and the outdoors helps people as they're healing. All kinds of things that have progressed over the last 70 years. And so they came out and said, well, do you own all the property that you're on? And we do. We're on 11 acres in Far East Dallas, really close to Mesquite, which you could never find now in Dallas County to be zoned for what we need it to be zoned for too. So they said, well, since you own all the property, it would actually be more cost efficient to build new because these buildings were built before 1970. They're going to have asbestos. They're going to have lead-based paint. So you're going to have to do abatement work when you start tearing stuff down.
Dang.
They're not set up for healthcare. So why don't you build what you really need? And so that began a very long capital project.
So this is 2020, 2021, you're starting this?
That was in 2020 when we started. We had a very generous foundation give us the seed gift for our first building.
Okay.
And so we raised $12 million to build the Doswell Medical Building, and that included some operating dollars to go along with that and a sustainability fund. So we opened that building in August of this past year.
$12 million. It cost $12 million to build that building.
The building itself was $7 million.
Okay.
And then we had the cost of the campaign, operating dollars, and the sustainability fund.
Okay.
But 12 is what we raised, which we're really proud of, because that was the most we'd ever raised privately. Thank you. And then the second phase is to build a new pregnant and parenting women with children living space and a new daycare. So that's where we are right now.
Where's that building going to go?
It's going to
go. Not that anybody has any idea what we're talking about. Where's it going to go? I need to see it.
Well, I can explain. So we're moving all of our residential buildings off of the main drive, which is La Prada, and the public alleyway, because we want everything to be more secure. Since those families are with us for 9 months, it's their home. It's where they're living. And so we want it to be really well protected. We have a lot of custody issues and intimate partner violence situations. So we don't want anybody to have to walk to the front of campus to face La Prada, where somebody could see them that maybe we don't want to.
Yeah, it makes sense.
So it's going back along the south side of the property.
Okay.
Behind the Doswell building. So that will be the closest street-facing building on the campus when we're done with everything.
And so that's the next building that you're building.
Yes.
And so that's what you're fundraising for right now.
That's what we're fundraising for now. This is a $35 million campaign because the square footage is so much more. So 23 will be hard construction costs, and then the other 12 is for operating expenses and a sustainability fund. So to be a 54-year-old organization, we do not have enough reserves built up. And so, yeah, here's where the, like, accounting nerd comes out, because I'm like, you need to have at least 6 months operating cash on hand for this size of an organization. And for our budget size, we should have an endowment, some type of investment fund that we can have for a rainy day. We don't have any of that.
Most companies don't. Those are fun things to have. Most companies don't. Most of us are living not paycheck to paycheck, but payroll to payroll. So
but for a nonprofit, it's just really important, because you don't know what's going to happen with
government funding.
Government funding, with public funding. Yes, all of that.
With the government shutdowns, does that affect your funding?
It didn't affect us because our grants are pass-through grants through the state.
Okay.
So it's not a direct federal payment. But it would have had it continued on for longer.
That's insane.
And it impacted our clients. So we have so many clients that are on SNAP benefits, and so it did impact them.
Yeah.
So we try to step in and fill those gaps. And we had food donations given to us, and so then we had food distributions that were going to our outpatient clients and our alumna.
That's amazing. How close are you to your goal, your foundation goal? I should probably actually know this, but how close are you?
We are at $4.5 million of the 35. The construction piece of that, like I said, is 23. So we're marching right along.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's so awesome. Yeah. Heather, thank you so much for coming on Pressure Tested today. I loved our conversation. I loved getting to know you more. Thanks so much.
Amazing.
Thank you.